This is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty. If you're listening to this around the time I release it, then you may realize that this show is out the same week that I posted a new podcast already. What follows is a short talk that Brenton Dickinson gave the same day I spoke at the 2016 Taylor University Colloquium. Both were part of several dozen papers presented at the colloquium, in addition to keynote addresses from Diana Glier, Colin Duryea, Serena Higgins, and Devin Brown. Britton's paper was called When Screwtape Haunts in Eden, Testing the Possibilities of the Screwtape Ransom Speculative Universe. In it, he gives the backstory to a fascinating discovery of how the Screwtape letters might have a connection with the series of fictional stories from Lewis, often called the Ransom Trilogy or the Space Trilogy. Brenton is no stranger to All About Jack. He's been on the podcast many times. You can find quick links to many of them in the show notes. That's where you'll also find a link to see the Prezi slides he shared that day. And then once he posts an article on his website, A Pilgrim in Narnia, about his talk, I'll include it in my show notes, which I'll remind you how to get to after the talk.
And I want to come to you as a student, which I am, with an idea that I don't want to just be cute. I want it to be substantial and to create new ways of speaking about the books that we love. And so I want to present to you today, not as an expert, but with some opportunity for response for you in the questions. And so I'm going to take a number of ideas. I'm going to let the suggestions percolate in the room, and we can talk about them throughout the rest of the weekend if you want, if that's your sort of thing. And then just focus on one particular area, if that's okay. And we'll look at it that way. So first, basically we want to set up what we're talking about here. I'm talking about Screwtape Haunting in Eden today as the one particular image that I want to look at. Now, we know we know these books, right? We know the trilogy, the Ransom Trilogy, actually is the phrase that Lewis uses it himself, and scholars start using it in about 1952 or thereabouts. And it goes out, Space Trilogy, Ransom Trilogy, the Planetary Books, etc. And we think of these as a unit, and we read them as a unit, and I think it's good to do so. And they all feature, Ransom, right? And they're pretty rough as a trilogy, but they connect. And of course, we had this book emerge later than Lewis in 1977, 78 is when people started really realizing what the content was. And you may have heard there's a bit of a discussion around it. If you don't, I would just pretend it doesn't exist for now. But granted that we have this book as an authentic C.S. Lewis incomplete book, we have a 4-book trilogy or a 3.5-book trilogy now, right? Well, I'm going to break that even further if I can. And it is useful to read these books in this particular order, although I really await Charlie's testing of his system to find out when that is. But I think what we have are second copies anyway, so it may not tell us when it was written. Within internal evidence, it seems like we've got that 38, 39, 40 kind of period for the Dark Tower. But, of course, there's other books that C.S. Lewis was writing at the same time. And I did a chronological C.S. Lewis reading project, and so I encountered, Pilgrim's Regress, then the essays and book reviews, which Hooper was nice enough to publish just as I was doing the project. Just as I hit 1928, 29, I had this whole new resource, and then we've got the couple essay books he puts out then, and then Out of the Silent Planet, and Problem of Pain, and the Screwtape Letters. And so there's a whole series of books, Preface to Paradise Lost, and I would encourage you to actually read those chronologically, and you'll start to see some of the links that I'm suggesting come from manuscript evidence today. Now, we know, of course, there's a speculative universe that's created out of C.S. Lewis's planetary books, The Field of Our Bull. But and if you're not fully convinced by Michael Ward's Planet Narnia thesis, you'll still find his book a rich resource for reading all the books, but in particular the Ransom books as well. Now, And thinking about this, we could ask the question simply, what would happen if we did read chronologically and we inserted Screwtape, you know, around the Dark Tower period or just after the Dark Tower period, and we would see that chronologically it works right before Perelandra. C.S. Lewis is writing the preface to Screwtape Letters as he's working on Perelandra, and at the time that he's sending Screwtape out to the publishers, he's got his guide to Eden, to Venus, and he's talking to the Eve character there. So that's the kind of contextual opportunity. But there's actually a curious, you know, kind of reality, right? This is actually what locals would have seen. We all know the Screwtape Letters for what they are. We probably understand, you know, some of the context that are there, but it's really a new kind of thing, and this is all that the readers were given at the time in The Guardian. It's the you know, the first of the series of serial letters are going to be published next week by Mr. C.S. Lewis, and you'll all know, of course, Pilgrim's Regress and Allegory of Love, which, of course, nobody would have known, or very few people would have known. The Problem of Pain, with a bit more contextual connection, I think, at that time. A keen demand is expected. I love this editor. If you have a chance to go to one of the libraries that has The Guardian, I didn't read through there. They actually wrote words and papers back then, and they're long. But I looked through into the 1939 to 1945 Guardian pieces at the General Theological Seminary in New York, and that was a great pleasure there. And I encourage you to do that if you like this sort of thing. This is how it begins, of course. This is just that right next to another article on the top right-hand column of page 211. You've got, not that issue in this series. You've got, "My dear Wormwood, I know what you say about guiding your patient's reading and taking care that he sees a good deal of his materialist friends, but are you not being a trifle naive?" Now, talk about in media res. This is throwing the reader right into, fire, I guess. I don't know how average readers would have taken it, but you can actually take a look at my blog, and there's a surprising lack of editorial response. There's only 6 editorial responses to the whole Screwtape Letter series. There's actually almost as many for the wartime piece that came out a year earlier. So when these books are picked up, he's got to create a preface, right? We know the preface. He's got to create a preface, and we've all read it, and he's nice enough to write this preface for us. "I've got no intention of explaining how the correspondence, which I now offer to the public, fell into my hands." So now the preface is not C.S. Lewis as the writer of the Screwtape Letters, but C.S. Lewis, I don't know, digging around the Bodleian and finding them, right? Going into Blackwell's, opening up a book and saying, "Hey, look, you know, demon letters," right? So, it's fun to sort of thinking about it, but he's working within a long epistolary tradition of discovery of letters, of recovery of letters, of editing of letters. And one of my MA students at Signum is here, and she may not know it yet, but maybe starting to suspect that I've actually created an epistolary fiction course without calling it that, largely to counter a particular theory of the development of epistolary fiction. But Lewis is working within that framework, and I think the fun of it, right? And then we go through the rest of the preface. Well, I was here 4 years ago. It's where I began. I did a paper on pedagogy and Screwtape. And I was really blown away by the conference. I was absolutely exhausted, and then I went right from here to the Wade Center, and I was going to look at C.S. Lewis's markings in his Bibles to see what was amazing about them. Nothing. There's absolutely nothing amazing about the markings. I encourage you not to travel there to do this thing, but if you're there, you can go ahead and look at it. He basically underlined pretty things, and so that may not be as helpful. Even in the Greek, he just put a little note on the side of interesting passages. And so, but I was going to look at the Screwtape manuscript at the time, but I delayed the satisfaction. My project was going nowhere. I had gotten an $8 grant to fly to, you know, to drive from Prince Edward Island to Wheaton to do the project. As you know how grants go, they cover, you know, about 4% of your work. And I'm there, and I'm tired. And so I said, okay, I would like to see the Screwtape manuscript now, please. And And actually, Serena is doing her Thorn work right on the same table, or the table behind, and I think the same table. And so this is the context. I open up the Screwtape Letters, and I had decided to move from biblical studies to C.S. Lewis studies. And I did that for a number of reasons, which I've blogged about. But what I wanted to do was take the tools from biblical studies and apply them to fantasy literature to see what sort of new fruit came out of that that soil. And so what I did with Paul, St. Paul was my study, was I suggested that his letters are a speculative universe, that he actually reorders the events that exist in his world in order to tell a story, and he uses characters, real people, but he makes them characters, typified characters, in order to do the job that he wants to do, which is not so much theology as pastoral care. And so that was my thesis. So I like letters. I like Screwtape Letters. I mean, they're Pauline in that sense. And I like the way that people create fictional worlds. They're actually creating fictional worlds. And so I was pretty comfortable with the interplay of real life and fiction that C.S. Lewis already has in his World War II era work. So I come to this with that particular perspective. I open up the Screwtape Letters, and inside is a typescript. So a second copy. The first copy is at the Berg in New York, which I also had an opportunity to spend some time with. And then there's a handwritten letter, which wasn't in the collection for Hooper, which was kind of neat. That was at the top, which I've talked about elsewhere. And then there's also the preface is there. And it's handwritten, as you expect. This emerged differently than the original the original hand script, right? So he wrote the letters, sent them to his editor at The Guardian. He put them into print, sent them back. He sent them to the publisher. Publisher's like, nobody's going to understand what's going on unless you give a preface. He writes a preface and sends it off. But the preface doesn't say what the preface says. It's a different preface that's in your first editions. Okay, this won't be a shock to everybody, and so I won't spend a lot of time on it.
It's way cool.
It is super cool, but I've already done. I've published it and I've talked about it, and so I don't want to spend all the time, or else I won't be able to steal your knowledge. Yeah, I sure can. Actually, let's hand it out. So I'm going to hand out to you the two prefaces on the back of this handout. We've got our student from Taylor here is going to help you with this. And we're going to look at this. This is published in Notes and Queries from a couple of years ago. It's an Oxford magazine, a journal. I needed to get into a PhD program, and they have a six-week turnaround. If you understand academic work, a six-week turnaround in academic work is phenomenal. So this actually got me into a PhD program, which has nothing to do with this particular letter, but that's okay. But basically, the first line I read is not, I don't have intention of telling you where I found them, but nothing will induce me to reveal how my friend Dr. Ransom got hold of the script, which is translated in these pages. Okay. And so then I just stopped, didn't read the rest of the letter, which it takes a while with C.S. Lewis anyway when you're new to his handwriting. But this was clear. He was writing it for somebody else. And I'm like, you know, so I just kind of stopped. And then I read it again. And then I read just the same paragraph again. And immediately you can see the speculative possibilities, right? So it's not him, the Oxford Don, discovering these letters. Who is it? It's our interstellar philologist, Dr. Elwin Ransom, right? The Ransom trilogy, right? Where the increasingly inaccurately named trilogy, and to use Douglas Adams' term. And so what we have is this moment, and you see, I came primed to ask the questions about how these universes are created from my biblical studies work, which I was already stealing from fantasy, as you can see, and then I'm in it, all right? And so I just sit there for I don't know how long, and then so finally I just have to go, look, Serena, I know you're doing this life-changing thing, but could you just tell me that what I'm seeing here is like a real thing, right? And she's like, are you serious? Like, what are you talking about, right? Now, there's a handful of people that have seen this too. And Charlie Starr, you're the first person to include it in print, right? But has anybody else seen this as well in the script? You've seen this, William. And so I've seen your names. I know it's you because you have to sign the thing out. And so there's a dozen... and you should sign the thing out. There's a dozen or so people that have done this. But what happens then, so if you flip to the back side of that paper, if it gets all the way... if you look, there's a side-by-side comparison of the two prefaces. And what you've got is is completely different first paragraph, but the second paragraph is the same. But they are almost the same. There are slight differences within it. And the third paragraph is almost the same. And then the last paragraph is the same, except instead of "I have not attempted to reproduce the time order," but Dr. Ransom hasn't done that, of course, because he's now the editor. So Lewis is the editor of the volume. Ransom's the translator. Now remember, Out of the Silent Planet, right? Lewis is the editor of this volume, this proposed fiction, which is fiction. Which is proposed fiction. And so, but we've got this mammoth, do you see this? This mammoth middle paragraph, and it's just like what? And so, there's just a lot of fun in there. I can't spend too much time on it, but I'm not going to make any mystery of the process whereby Dr. Ransom learned the language. It's old Solar. Well, of course it is, right? What would the demons speak? You know, what would the Eldil of Earth speak? Well, they speak old Solar, as Eldil do on other places, although, of course, anglicized or Japanized or whatever, right? How Ransom came to learn it, we've already talked about in the previous book. For publishers, you should know this is a good tie-in. And then it's local speech, and there's a series of conversation. The translation's necessarily free. The capital letters are used as pronouns to refer to that being whom Screwtape describes as the enemy, is a most ingenious device of Ransom. So we see that within the language, there's actually something essential about old Solar language, and anybody who's thought about Tolkien and language can see the possibilities that exist here. Now, what we have, of course, is a 4.5 book trilogy, then, if we want to think it about that way, at least from a speculative or a heuristic standpoint. This gives us a chance as readers to rethink, so not to negate what's gone before, but to ask what new possibilities emerge from this particular approach, right? We're not taking, oh yeah, everybody's published before, you know, I did that. Okay, no. It's just, this adds a new layer of thinking about some of these worlds. Well, what kind of layers? So language and script, which we already talked about a little bit. So, I've already read this. We can imagine the linguistic possibilities, and I don't want to talk about them too much, except to connect them to what happens in Paralandra, oops, right? So, what language? So remember, Ransom's going to be preparing to go to Paralandra. Well, how will you talk to the people? Oh, that's okay. I already learned it. It's old Solar. It's the language everybody speaks. I'm already ready for it. Well, how did you learn it? Well, I learned it on Malachandra. It's Hresahlup, right? There's actually a longer version of it. So we see actually the tie-in that happens in the beginning of Paralandra. Notice Verlin Flieger in 1992 wrote an article that sort of notes the problematic features of this, and nerds through history have done their best to create these linguistic lists. And I would encourage you, if you want to follow this up, my long-term project has this, but I know that you'll get it as a room, and so I'm going to leave it, and we're going to move on to something that I think is a bit more in the literary critical level that I want to talk about here. We also have interesting questions about writing systems and all that kind of stuff. The unman. Again, you'll immediately get it. When we talk about Screwtapian realities within Paralandra, you immediately want to go to the unman. I don't think I want to spend a ton of time here, because what we have is actually not something specifically Screwtapian, but from the Screwtapian world, which is a demonic possession, right? And so, Ransom and Weston are speaking. How does Weston speak so well in Old Solar? Well, no problem. He's been taught, right? Oh, I've been prepared. You didn't notice why. I've improved a bit. Guidance. And so there's this croaking Weston unman. And it's at this point in the story in Paralandra that he just begins to fall apart. He has this demonic fit and then crashes for a few hours into the darkness of the fixed land in Paralandra. And it's actually, there's some really troubling imagery that's connected with this particular piece. There's actually a death moment that happens here. So, And then I'm going to leave that because I know you folks will understand what the implications are. And if you want to play that out, you're welcome to it. That the future, ultimately, I will get to all this stuff. What else? Cosmology now we can think about differently. The cosmogony, the creation of the world, once that's tied into the satanic realities in a much more explicit way, we have more to think about there, including the things that Screwtape talks about the fall of the Father Below, right? Now those fit within an understanding of the Ariyasar of Earth in a new way. Eldilology is what I'm calling it. That's not a real word, but it is now, okay? Sci-fi, mythopoeia, all those sorts of things. The epistolary fiction conversation is important. If you notice a feature of Lewis's work, it's very epistolary, right? Diaries, letters, the use of the first person, even in that hideous strength, chapter 1.3, there's one section. Lewis comes in and falls asleep at a well, and then we have the rest of the story. Dreams, that sort of thing. Lewis is a character in his own fiction, which I've referenced here, which I think is kind of fun. And then, of course, the way that Lewis created worlds, which is the larger project. Well, what I want to think about, though, is how do we think about Screwtape, though? So not just demonic stuff, but Screwtape. And I think that William's paper does a great job of really making a problem of my paper, which I knew coming into this because I knew his thesis, because I'm hoping he'll sign his book for me. And I didn't have a book, so I'll sign William's book, too, if you want. Okay. So remember, we've got Ransom coming off the train, right, Lewis coming off the train to go and visit Ransom. Lewis is in his own world, as his own person, visiting the fictional Dr. Ransom, comes off the train, and then he has this series of just terrifying experiences as he walks from Worcester to Ransom's cottage. Lewis feels uneasy. He's afraid of the Eldilla. He's afraid that he'll get drawn in. And, of course, we know that the significance of that within this series. We actually see Mark and Lewis are really parallel, if you can imagine them. Lewis in chapter 1 of Perelandra, and then Mark throughout that hideous strength. The fear is that numinous or ethereal thing, but also the fear of the inner ring. What begins as this sort of mental conversation becomes this darkness and mist and disorientation as he travels down what's probably a relatively small path from the station to Ransom's cottage. He even loses his own bag and just wants to go back. And the impulse whispers to him, go back with this astonishing force. He becomes afraid of the shapes in the darkness, still thinking about the extraterrestrials that Ransom described in Out of the Silent Planet, the Sorns, right? Those images come into his mind. He suspects he's having a breakdown. Absolute terror nearly overwhelms him. And as he reaches Ransom's house, it is still dark, and he describes his mental state. I staggered on into the cold and darkness, already half convinced that I must be entering what is called madness, right? And he falls into intellectual doubt and reflection about madness itself, as he would. Sheer fear of the dark, and he's just terrified. And his match can't stay lit, right? The little bit of light that he trusts in doesn't work. And then he says, I've naturally no wish to enlarge on this phase of my story. My state of mind is one that I look back on with humiliation, and I would have passed it over, but it really captures the essence of the book, which is what this story is all about. Somehow or other, despite the loathing and dismay that pulled me back and a sort of invisible wall of resistance that met me in the face, fighting for each step and almost shrieking as a harmless spray of the hedge that touched my face, I managed to get through the gate and up the little path. And there I was, drumming on the door and ringing at the handle and shouting to him to let me in as if my life depended on it. And what's the concrete threat? Like darkness. That's it. A cat that crosses the path. There's no reply. He can't get his match lit, and then eventually Ransom arrives home. Actually, pretty quickly after Lewis, and Ransom comes in the door, and Lewis says, "Oh, thank God, Ransom!" Right? And then Ransom, they're talking, and he says, "Oh, so you got through the barrage without any damage?" Ransom asks, and the barrage? I don't understand. Well, I was thinking you might have met with some difficulties in getting here. Oh, that, said I. You mean it wasn't just my nerves? There really was something in the way? Yes, they didn't want you to get here. I was afraid something of the sort might happen. and there was no time to do anything about it. I was pretty sure you'd just get through somehow. I mean, send the guy a text. I'm just saying, you know. By they, do you mean the others, our own Eldilla? Well, of course, they got wind of what's at hand. And I interrupt him, to tell you the truth, Ransom, I'm getting more worried every day about the whole business. Oh, they'll put all sorts of things into your head if you let them, said Ransom lightly. The best plan is to take no notice and keep straight on. Don't try to answer them. Well, so is William right, or am I right? Okay, so what we've got here is the opposite of a good classic Screwtapian temptation. I mean, I hope that William's sheet is substantial enough to suggest that he's on the right track, right? That the high gold level mark for Screwtapian temptation is to keep things out, but you do put things in as you go. Well, what we've got is the extreme opposite of that. We've got the absolute putting of things in, a complete seizing of terror and fear, not a possession, but an oppression or something of a substantial quality. And it's important for us to think about that. And really, I'm going to leave it there over the next 2 minutes and let you think about that. We know the connections, the Dark Lord, Bent Eldil, Oyasa of Telus, the Lacandra, or Earth. We've got that. He's the father below. We can see how those links work. It's pretty obvious once you've asked the questions, right? We also think of the Miltonian kind of Satan, right? The subtlest beast of all the field in Milton's Paradise. I argue that what we see here are all these connections, but granted that unified feature of Lewis's inventing world, we recognize that this severe temptation experience, it doesn't look Screwtapian. Well, it's not terribly subtle, to be frank. Well, what I want to do, though, is suggest that what we've got is an upside-down version of something that happens in the Screwtape letters. Do you remember when the victim is walking that day? He goes for a nice walk in a pleasant place with a book that he likes to read. He's thinking about the girl that he loves, all that sort of thing. And I think what we've got is the mirror image of this that has taken place. And Worman's chief failure, because it's actually a key point in the narrative structure of Screwtape letters, this walk, what we've got is the mirror image of this. What Wormwood failed to produce was exactly what is produced in Paralandra, maybe to a hyperbolic level, but the stakes are high. What you've got in the victim of Screwtape letters is average Joe that might help a few nice people during the war before he dies. What you've got in Paralandra is the beginning of an epic interstellar battle between all of these forces. And so I think that's why we've got the hyperbolic version of the Screwtapian vision within this piece. I want to leave it there with us to ask this question back to you and for you to tell me about whether you think that's a credible reading. For what we've got is, within this structure, once we start to think about the ramifications of this piece, we want to be thinking about not just the manuscript history and a bunch of nerds are working on all that kind of stuff, but what we've also got is the literary critical, the theological, and maybe even the pastoral that goes to the nth degree and brings all those together. And I'm going to leave it at this point and then submit it back to the community to talk about.
I trust you found what Britton had to say interesting. I know I did. Be sure to visit and follow his blog called A Pilgrim in Narnia, where he explores a variety of issues and has previously mentioned some of the ideas shared in the talk you just heard. I'm William O'Flaherty, the creator of All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. Be sure to check the show notes to find the Prezi slides Brenton used during his talk, and there's also a direct link to his site and to some of the previous All About Jack shows he has been on. You can find those show notes either at EssentialCSLewis.com or allaboutjack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the podcast is more easily found. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. The other location, EssentialCSLewis.com, provides links back to where the audio files are hosted along with other content. When you visit, please consider listening to other podcasts. At the time this show is posted, my most recent new shows include my own talk I gave at Taylor. It was called Battlefield of the Mind, Examining Screwtape's Preferred Method. Prior to that, I shared a show spotlighting Lewis's greatest sermon, The Weight of Glory, with a variety of guests, and I also recently posted an interview with Dr. Michael Ward about C.S. Lewis at Poets' Corner, a new book that came out in 2016. Consider also checking out my iTunes feed, where each day I repost an older show. You can also access that via the allaboutjack.podbean.com page. Finally, let me remind you, or in case you didn't know, I have a book called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters. It's available online at Amazon in paperback for $14.99, and presently for the Kindle, it's just $5.49. You can learn more about my book by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get an immediate download of a free 20-page PDF sample of the book. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Thank you.